It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to. Lots to talk about. Some good news today. Good news. Gonna make my conservative friends lose their minds. The hashtag trending today, thank you, Brandon, which is kind of hysterical in that the right wing, you know, all of the Trump maggot folks have been out there. Let's go, Brandon. Well, Brandon actually did something today. Really, really good, strong economy numbers. 531,000 jobs created in October, a three-month average. And this is one of those things where you go, the last guy didn't have this. A three-month average of 442,000 new jobs. Private sector saw the biggest gain. They said 604,000. Lost some in the public sector as that is contracting. Manufacturing jobs grew by 60,000, construction over 44,000. Lots of good numbers, good stuff. In fact, wage growth, fairly strong. That's a good thing. Need a little bit of bump. Good thing in my view. What we didn't have today, didn't have the movement on the infrastructure and the Build Back Better plan. Started off okay. We were going to get some votes on this. The House was ready to go. They were going to move both pieces of legislation. It was going to be great. A 10-year plan on the budget reconciliation side of $1.85 trillion on social and environmental spending. Good stuff. And we'll go through some of that. And then came the bickering. Understand, good, strong economy numbers. The economy is doing fairly well. I mean, given the fact that we're coming out of a pandemic, given the fact that all of the challenges that have gone on and a Republican Party hell-bent on making sure everyone is miserable, and a conservative media that always is, it's all bad, the sky's falling. Job numbers actually really good. Now, here's the thing, and this is where I think Democrats, as I said, they better go and find a picket line this weekend. They better go find a worker and follow them around. They better go get that master's class on working class economics that happens every time there's a strike line, because they got nothing done today. Again, there was high hopes. There was talk, oh, we're going to get this through and it's going to happen. You're going to get the bill to the desk, all that. And then an abrupt stop. Because of, you know, the Democrats' internal division. Now, go home. This is all the wrong messaging. If it's me, I'm the leader. I'm like, no, we're not leaving here until we get something done. Just took a thrashing on Tuesday in many places because we didn't deliver. Time to deliver. Time to put some points on the board. Something. And hammer it out. Get it done. But they're going to go back, spend the week. Again, the wrong messaging. You didn't get the job done, and now you're going to go for a week away. But take this week. Go find a working person and figure this out. Because, look, in this Build Back Better plan, there's a lot of good stuff in this. The hard infrastructure stuff isn't difficult. We know what that is, which roads and bridges. It's water infrastructure. It's broadband. It's all of the things that we desperately need and have needed for years now. This is not rocket science. It's the reason you did get some Republicans to come along, because they're like, hey, this can score me points back home. I'm going to support it. But I would argue the social and the environmental spending will score points back at home as well, especially in rural communities. I mean, this is the part where Democrats always seem to fall down, because they've fallen into this trap. And the Republicans do this well. They have really done a great job of fostering this urbans versus the rurals. When the reality is, you know, this Build Back Better plan overwhelmingly supports rural communities. because, well, this is the place where you do need more investment in early childhood education, where you need more investment in child care, where you need more investment in, well, guess what? Poverty is just as high in rural communities, I would argue even higher than it is in most urban communities. So they need the child tax credit is just as much. So it's interesting how we allow these things to be framed without the Democrats coming out and saying, look, this is the reality. This isn't right or left. This isn't rural, urban. This is up, down. This is rich, poor. This is, if you need the helping hand, we're going to get it to you. We're going to make lives better. You know, what happened to that, you know, chicken in every pot, a Chevy in every driveway kind of mentality that the old school politicians understood? It's about making lives better. It's not about tearing apart. It's not about division. It's about how do we make everyone better and not slicing and dicing and saying, well, we're going to help them over here, but not these. No, it's about helping all of the working class. And that's what this Build Back Better plan does. And that's what they've got to start hammering more. And look, we've got a media culture that they don't want to tell that story because they're hung up in the horse race. They're hung up in the boxing match. They're hung up in them slugging it out and, of course, not getting anything done. Because, you know, how boring would it have been, you know, on cable news? We go, well, you know, the Democrats actually got something done today and it's going to help make people's lives better. Well, what are we going to talk about for the next 23 hours and 59 minutes? That's the real. Well, things are going to get better. We got nothing to complain about. I guess we go about the rest of our lives. We go do something else. This is the thing that drives me crazy. This is all stuff that could and should be done already. Like I said, you know, this Build Back Better plan would make massive investments in early childhood education. 3 and 4 year olds going to get to go to get the preschool and get that advantage because, you know, the studies are there. We know. And this is one of those things where, you know, I think about myself. You know, my wife and I were fortunate. We had the resources to be able to pay to have our children go to a good quality, you know, pre-K program. And when our kids went to kindergarten, they were beyond ready. They were 100% ready. They were reading. They were doing all the stuff that you go, wow, they're so far ahead. And what happened? Well, what happened is they languished while waiting for the other kids to catch up. So basically what we did is we had wasted, you know, resources. And we had wasted resources that, you know, we were hoping would put them way ahead, ended up making them, well, you already understand this. Go over the corner and we'll deal with the kids who didn't get it. And it was infuriating because every kid should have that opportunity. Every kid should have been that far ahead so that it makes life easier going forward and it gets better. So for me, this is a no-brainer, making sure that every kid's ready to go and all of that, no-brainer to me. The investment in child care, you know, family in this economy, you need two incomes. Don't like it, hate it, wish it were different. That's the reality. Helping families get child care, this is a big part of this. And I don't really know many people. I know a couple. Well, you know, I didn't get any. You get that crowd. And on a lot of these fronts, you get that crowd. Well, we didn't have that when I was younger. Well, of course not. Because you weren't smart enough to push for it. But just because you did it bad in the past, just because you did it wrong yesterday, doesn't mean you have to continue to do it wrong tomorrow. Also, going to deliver some care for people who need it. Seniors to stay in their homes. People with disabilities to stay in their homes. There's a lot of good in this. And smart. I mean, that's the problem. I guess that's the problem. If there are smart policies in here, we can't possibly have them. It seems to be. Also, the $300 a month that will continue for the next year, which will help, you know, 39 million households stay out of poverty and kids won't go to hungry. And here's the part that blows my mind. Remember, the Republicans keep telling us they're the party of family values and how much they love the children. Love the children. Except when we have to feed them. And this is one of those ways that we can do that. Now, I have people say, well, this is socialism. It's handouts. I don't hear many people complaining, and I know lots of people getting it. You know, there are millions of people getting it. Not too many complaints when they're getting it. It's just when those people get it. define those people however you have to. And the thing is, you know, we can expand this stuff to help all children, to help all seniors. We can create an environment where the edges of the capitalist knife are not as sharp. And that we make people's lives better. I mean, this is the part that, you know, I keep coming back to. For me, it's not about Democrat, Republican, right, left. It's about how do we get things done? How do we make lives better? How do we make people's lives easier? I mean, ultimately, it's about, isn't that what we're supposed to be doing? Isn't that what we want our government to do? Now, there's also in this, you know, if you've been hearing about the reports coming out of this CHOP 26, which Greta Thunberg is saying is nothing but a PR stunt, and I agree. Nothing's going to come out of that. There's a historic investments in helping to fight climate change. Something I worry about my kids. Look, I'm not that concerned for myself. We're probably not going to live to see the really bad effects. 2070 is well down the road for me. But when you have a report that comes out in 2070 that says, you know, that year, you know, 3 billion people are going to live in places that are uninhabitable, you're talking about chaos. You're talking about wars. You're talking about mass refugee crisis. You're just talking about just all kinds of chaos and a planet on fire. And you go, we can do better than that. We can, this is where we go, you know, we can care about our grandchildren, even if they're not born yet. Help us move towards, you know, cleaner, greener technologies. Help that transition along, as we've done in the past with a lot of things. We can plant more trees. We can do more things. You know, they want this climate conservation corps, about 300,000 people, to do like my great-grandparents did. Go and make forests. Go and plant trees. Go and do things that need to be done. Create the jobs of the next generation. But sadly, we're in this political polarized moment where even common sense doesn't matter anymore. Or even what's good for us. I mean, my mind's blown away over this vaccine thing. I'm still, every day I go, I cannot believe we're in this moment. It's just insane. But look, I hope the Democrats go back, and I hope they do what they have to do to get us moving in a direction that we start talking about this bill and what's in it, and not about them fighting and bickering. Because if it's about them fighting and bickering, it doesn't get done. And I need this. We need this to get done. Now, I do find it interesting that the economy doing well. Things, you know, everybody I talk to doing okay. And yet I saw this video yesterday from CNN that went viral. Evidently, there's this family, has 11 family members. They drink 12 gallons of milk a week. And they are complaining that the cost of milk has gone through the roof. In fact, they say that this is one of those things that you go, really? Because of inflation, they're saying that a gallon of milk that they used to pay for, you know, before the pandemic was $1.99 a gallon. And they're now, because of inflation, paying $2.79. I got to tell you, I don't know where you get a gallon of milk for $1.99. You know, I'm not the one who goes shopping in the family. But I do know it's been well higher than that for a very long time. And it's these kind of anecdotal, oh my God, the sky's falling, that has, and it being reported on by places like CNN, that this is factual. I don't remember the last time that milk was $1.99. It's probably been years. But it's this kind of frame that, oh my God, the sky's falling. And the reality is prices are going up a little bit. Milk has jumped by 26% since 2018. But that has less to do with the pandemic and more to do with consolidation and the fact that, well, we're losing dairies at an alarming rate to massive consolidation. But no, we're going to blame COVID for it. And is COVID making it worse? COVID's making everything a little worse. But it's this monopolizing of all of our industries that's doing this. You know, are prices going up? Yeah, but so are wages. And understand, prices aren't going up anywhere near where they were in the 70s because we keep getting this, wow, it's the 1970s. No, it's not. It's not. The sky is falling mentality. We got to calm down a little bit. calm down a little bit. And finally, Labor Secretary Marty Walsh. Biden has come out and said, look, by, I guess, January 4th it is, we're moving on the vaccine thing. Marty Walsh said, look, yeah, I think people need to read the rules. The Labor Department, the federal government, has every right to impose a vaccine mandate on private businesses. Their job is to keep workplaces safe. And for me, this is one of those moments where we have failed ourselves. We really have. We have failed ourselves in that you have so many people who are going to try and flout the rules. I'm better than this. And there are going to be all these fights and all this stuff that's going to create more polarization. And in the meantime, the virus who doesn't care who you voted for in the last election, the virus who doesn't care whether you're wearing a mask or not wearing a mask, vaccinated or unvaccinated, is going to try and figure out how to get stronger. And sadly, we could potentially end up right back where we started from. Because we don't have the kind of sense anymore to go, how do we protect ourselves? I literally had someone the other day tell me, well, it's no different than the flu. Everybody I know who's had it, it's just like the flu. You get sick, you get better. Except for the 750,000 people who didn't. Except for the millions of people who have the long COVID, who have pre-existing conditions that are going to be hanging around for quite some time. And we're stuck, talking about Aaron Rodgers. I personally don't care about Aaron Rodgers. I care about the guy on the factory floor. I care about the person working for the trucking company. I care about the person working in the supermarket who has to be exposed to the people around him who look at this and go, oh, well, the perfect health specimen. He barely had anything, and he gets ivermectin. We're just in such a weird, insane spot where we can't even look at each other and go, I care that you don't get this. I care if you get sick, and I care if you get me sick. And how do we make sure that we figure this out? It's so bizarre. It's such a weird, weird position that we find ourselves because of our whatever stripe we put on our political sleeve. Insane, crazy, and all of the above. And the fact that we can't agree on getting granny chompers. We are in such a screwed up spot. But I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break when we come back and talk a little bit about the open enrollment period of the ACA. Right back after this. Stick around. There's nothing more American than workers standing up, and the union gives a voice to win. On the Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1945. That was the day workers in Windsor, Ontario, walked off the job in a general strike to support strikers at Ford Motor Company. 20,000 CIO workers brought the city's industrial production to a complete standstill. 11,000 members of UAW Local 200 had been on strike against Ford since September 12th. They demanded a union shop and dues checkoff. As the strike wore on, picket lines swelled every day with as many as 1,000 to 2,000 amassing at the gates to stop scabs. Then, on this day, more than 9,000 additional members of Amalgamated UAW Local 195, working at 27 area plants, joined them in support. Thousands of picketers set up a blockade at Ford's riverfront plant that tied up the city's transit system. Sandwich Street was choked with cars, buses, and trucks. More than 1,000 cars were bumper to bumper in an endless traffic jam as strikers worked to prevent a police attack on the picket lines. The two-mile blockade and general strike were in effect for 2 days until the government threatened to send in federal troops to aid provincial and Canadian police. Thousands continued to picket. By November 12th, AFL and CIO leaders throughout Canada were calling for a work holiday to show support. Then, on December 19th, workers agreed to binding arbitration. Supreme Court Justice Ivan Rand was assigned the case. He ruled against the closed shop, but for dues checkoff.
he put forth a series of rules and penalties regarding labor disputes that would come to be known as the Rand Formula. It has served as the basis for labor relations and collective bargaining in Canada ever since.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So it appears, everything I just said, forget about it. Evidently, they're going to vote. I guess they didn't leave. I guess the bus ticket didn't get stamped yet. There may be some voting happening on the bipartisan infrastructure bill and the Build Back Better plan. We'll see. We'll see what happens. I am not holding my breath. I am not going to do it again. Not going there. Just not going to do it. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on, well, what is actually happening as things change and develop. I've asked our good friend Laura Packer to come and talk to us. Laura is a stage 4 cancer survivor and executive director of Healthcare Voter. Laura, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me back. And I was just having a conversation just a few hours ago saying, they're done. They're walking away. It'll happen with Thanksgiving. And then wait, more news.
Yeah, I'm like, make up your mind already. Are you going to do it or aren't you? We need it desperately, desperately need it. So I guess what are the odds now? What are the chances of them actually getting something accomplished?
Well, Biden put out a statement just a few minutes ago, and it sounds like what the plan, and we'll see if this actually comes true, but that tonight they will vote on the bipartisan infrastructure bill in the House, and then they will vote on the rule for the Build Back Better. So that not the actual bill, but the procedural stuff, because a few so-called moderate Democrats said they wouldn't vote for that bill until there was a CBO score, until all the financial stuff came out. And right, that won't happen for a week or so. So the plan, again, is vote for the first bill tonight, vote for procedural stuff on the second bill, and everybody promises they will vote for the real thing in a couple weeks when all the financial stuff comes out.
Except for the people with their fingers behind their back, crossed behind their back. So if they do pass the bipartisan infrastructure bill, this goes to Biden's desk then. Is that what I understand?
Yes, because it's already passed the Senate. So if the House doesn't make any changes, if they just vote it as is, it goes to Biden for his signature.
All right, so we may actually see something get done, and before the weekend and before they go away. That would be good messaging.
Yes, although the election already happened. But I would just like to point out, first of all, no Republicans are voting for this. So as much as I point out the Democrats that are dragging their feet, zero Republicans are doing the right thing. And second, it's just a few Democrats that are really holding things up in both the House and the Senate. The vast majority of the elected Democrats in the House and in the Senate support both these bills. It's just a few people that are gumming up the works.
Yeah, no, it's one of those things where you got to get something done, guys. Come on, something.
Yeah, and I think that maybe the results in New Jersey and in Virginia hopefully made it clear that the American public is not happy right now, and Democrats need to deliver if they want to be reelected.
Yeah, no, it's that simple. So this is actually pretty good news then. I mean, this is potentially something helpful.
Yes. I mean, I am more interested in the second bill because it's got all the healthcare pieces, all the human infrastructure pieces. And I mean, I care about roads and bridges, but it's not that's the easy part. The right. Hard part is the other stuff.
Now, what do you think the chances are of one going and the other? Because, that's always been the fear, that the fear is that they coupled them together so that, the easy stuff gets done and then the harder stuff comes along. What are the chances of, we got what we wanted. Sorry, that's the end of the road.
I mean, that's always a possibility, and that worries me. So far, progressives have really played this smartly, not voting when they had the power to not vote, and making sure that the second bill didn't get killed, keeping them together, making sure the second bill stays alive. So we'll see.
Now, as the executive director of Healthcare Voter, what's in this Build Back Better plan? Because, look, we've been hearing a lot about numbers. It's $6 trillion, $3.5 trillion, trillion three-quarters, trillion eight-five. You know, just numbers all over the place and bickering. Lots of bickering, lots of fighting. And I don't think most people know what's in it. On the healthcare front, how will this social infrastructure spending, how will this help people get healthcare?
Okay. First of all, it makes the tax subsidies that were in the American Rescue Plan to make ACA health insurance plans cheaper. Those expire next year. And so it extends them out through 2025. Second, it fills the Medicaid gap. So low-income people in places like Texas and Florida and Georgia and North Carolina can't get health insurance right now because they don't qualify for any help through the ACA, but they also can't get Medicaid. So they're locked out. And that's over 2 million Americans that can't get healthcare that need it most. So it fixes that also through 2025. It now lowers the cost of prescription drugs through Medicare negotiation. So I think it's 10 drugs to start and then more drugs after that. But what's interesting to people even that don't have Medicare is that it would cap insulin costs at $35 a month, whether you have Medicare or not. So that's a big, big thing for diabetics.
Right.
And it would also strengthen Medicare by including a hearing benefit.
Yeah, I wish it was all of the dental and the vision as well, but evidently that not possible. But, you know, I look at this and you said, you know, Texas, you said Georgia, you said Alabama, Mississippi, you said those states, right? And my first thought is, didn't they vote for Trump? Why is Biden helping them? Aren't we supposed to be punishing the people who don't come along with us?
Well, I think two brand new senators in Georgia and one very powerful and an inspirational senator in Wisconsin have been pushing for this, as well as Jim Clyburn in the House in South Carolina and House Democrats. Because, I mean, this is just plain wrong. You know, 2 million Americans can't get health care and they're low income. They need it most. And regardless of where they live, they shouldn't be punished for the bad choices of their elected officials. In many cases, it's so gerrymandered, they never had a shot at electing anybody.
Now, of course, I'm not being serious, but, you know, the former guy, you know, that side may have. But I'm looking at this because a lot of times things are framed between the rurals and the urbans. And I look at this Build Back Better plan, and a lot of the help goes to, urban areas and rural areas that didn't support Biden, that are probably never going to support Biden. But it's being done because it's absolutely the right thing that has to be done.
I mean, I think that's one difference between conservatives and liberals is I think everybody should have health care, whether they voted for Biden or not. And I'm not sure that conservatives believe that.
Now, you know, I look at this and, you know, strengthening the ACA is something I know you're big on because you think it's important. And look, I think it's what we've got. We've got to strengthen it. It's got to happen. This is one of those moments where you go, doing the right thing is easy, but it's so hard for us to get to that spot. And I'm looking at this, what's going on with this vote, why it's taken so long, all of this. And it's easy to get frustrated, isn't it?
Yes. And I mean, if we had more than 50 senators that believed in democratic ideals, then we would be a lot further along. But I mean, the truth is that very small majorities in both the House and in the Senate means that it's easy for big pharma and big corporations to buy people off.
Yeah.
And so that is the system we live in at the moment.
See, isn't this this is the perfect scenario. I mean, everybody hates big pharma. Everybody hates big monopolistic corporate America. This is where the push should be. That's the bad guy. That's the evildoer, to use a Bush frame. Not my neighbor, not the guy who votes for the Republican. I mean, we've framed things we've had things framed for us in all the wrong ways. Right, left, progressive, moderate, Democrat, Republican. It's rich, poor. It's always been rich, poor. It's always been the moneyed interest versus everyone else.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the reasons why the first draft, the framework from the White House, did not have the provision to lower prescription drugs. And then there was so much of an outcry in the last few days that it's back in, because if you speak up, you really can make a difference.
Yeah. Now you're someone who clearly, as a stage four cancer survivor, you know the healthcare system, the real healthcare system, from the inside out, and the costs associated with that. When you're talking about these drugs, we're talking massive amounts of money, aren't we?
Yes. And we pay more than any other country. I think we pay 2 to 3 times more than any other country, because every other country uses their buying power to negotiate, to force these big pharmaceutical companies to come to the table. And we're the only ones that say, we'll pay whatever number is on the bill. You write a number on the bill and we'll pay it. No arguments.
Because we're Americans, damn it. We pay full price. Isn't that stupid? I mean, really, when you listen to what you just said, every other country in the world uses their bargaining power to negotiate themselves the best prices. Now, again, conservatives are the ones who tell us the power of the free market, that we should be able to exercise the power of economies of scale, of the free market, the invisible hand, all that stuff. And yet, what they've done is they've chopped off the invisible fingers and tied the invisible hands together. It's insane that the people who tell us that they believe the free market so much are the ones who are actually blocking the quote-unquote free market.
And this is incredibly popular because it's just common sense. The only people it's not common sense for are the people that are being paid very well not to do it.
Yeah. Now, one of those people, that the allegation is she's been paid very well to do it, is Senator Dipsy Doo from Arizona, who's the one who's been, I call her Senator Dipsy Doo for the little dance she did when she shot down the minimum wage increase, because I don't get what the hell that was. But, she's gotten some money from Big Pharma. And part of this holdup, I think, is partially that, or is that too jaded?
She is a top recipient of Big Pharma dollars, and I'm sure they are making calls to her, telling her what they want her to do for that money. So, yeah, I mean, I think if she wasn't getting Big Pharma money, she'd be in a lot different place on this bill.
Yeah, isn't this one of those moments where now we start talking about, we can't get the things that people want, because, you talk to people about what's actually in this Build Back Better plan. It polls really well. It's very popular. People want, early childhood education to get their children an education. They want free college, which I understand not in this anymore, but they want to expand the college years to help their students. They want to get, children fed. They want granny to get some chompers and some glasses. They want these things that are in there. And yet the moneyed interest have figured out how to rig this game so that we, the people, never quite get what we want, or more importantly, what we need. And yet they seem to keep doing well time and time again. Isn't this time to start talking about some major campaign finance reforms, some way of getting this huge monopolistic money out of our government?
Well, that's why I hope that next up, once we get through this, is working on HR1 and reforming the way we run elections and campaign finance in this country, because right now it is far too easy for big money to push elected officials around. It's incredibly popular, the things in this bill, and also taxing the rich to pay for it is incredibly popular too. And yet here we are, and it's unclear what all is going to make it in.
Yeah, how is that not possible? I mean, wait a second. We've got people making millions of dollars a year, tens of millions of dollars a year, paying less of a tax rate than someone who is literally sweeping the streets. How is it fair? How is it sane? How is it rational? And how does it continue to be? This is one of those things where if we framed things, I think, differently, maybe there would be the pitchforks out. Maybe there would be the riots. The fact that our kids aren't getting the opportunities that we deserve. Our seniors aren't getting what they're entitled to, because we've got 745 USDA certified billionaires who pocketed a cool $2.1 trillion over the pandemic. And we've got to protect their profits, Laura. We got to protect them.
And this bill is now under $2 trillion. So it's just money buys influence and power in our system, and they protect their wealth.
So the vote is happening as we speak. What should we be doing other than crossing our fingers, doing the pray thing? Do you do that?
Well, I think you should contact your representatives. If you haven't yet, contact your representative, contact your senators, tell them you want them to vote for Build Back Better and include all the healthcare pieces, because no matter what happens tonight, the Senate still has to do their thing too. And it sounds like Manchin is gonna do some writing, some rewriting. We'll see what he comes up with. So it is so important to keep contacting your senators as well as your representative.
While he sits on his gigantic boat driving around in his Maserati, you go, what? How is it that this guy represents the poor, one of the poorest states in the country? A guy who's who lives on a yacht and drives a Maserati. I don't know.
Make a good living as a senator, I guess.
No, not really. I mean, 175 grand a year is a reasonable living. Not driving a Maserati, living on a yacht. I don't know that you can do that. There's a lot more to this.
Yeah, and I mean, that's one of the things, reasons why we need campaign finance reform.
Yeah, and especially in West Virginia. I mean, a state that so desperately needs healthcare. I've got friends who live there, and their healthcare system is in dire need of help. There is so much that Manchin could bring back to that state, so much that this kind of legislation can do for rural areas. I mean, that's the part that blows my mind. In this is so much for the people who hate Biden the most, the ones who are screaming, let's go, Brandon, instead of saying, thank you, Brandon.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a whole other issue with misinformation and disinformation and the way that our media system is just collapsing and people can't get good factual information anymore. But thank you for your show.
There you go. Laura, I appreciate the time. As always, great talk with you. We'll see you back here in the next hour during the panel. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Our good friend Laura Packard. No, I mean, seriously, at the end of the day, when you look at this, the fact that this isn't a no-brainer, that this hasn't just sailed through and become law already, is a testament of how broken our system is and how we better figure out how to get back into the streets and talking to each other, maybe back to the bars, have a drink, something, that maybe the common will, the things that we want and need that are in this, that are popular, that poll really well, that maybe we get done. I know it's a stretch. I know it's difficult, but maybe we can have that happen. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1916. That was the day when what came to be known as the Everett Massacre took place in Washington State. The Everett Shingle Workers Union had gone out on strike in May. Organizers from the industrial workers of the world came to the area to support the strike and to make a stand for free speech. Over the summer, tensions began to mount. The police began to arrest IWW speechmakers. Then, in August, violence erupted between strikebreakers and picketers at the Jameson Mill. The IWW decided to bring in a group of about 300 members for a free speech rally. They came from Seattle by two steamer boats. But the first boat was met at the docks by the sheriff and a large group of armed deputies. A gun battle broke out. One passenger, Ernest Nordstrom, told the harrowing tale of what happened to the Seattle Union Record, saying, quote, "I couldn't swear where the first shot came from, but as it comes to me, I thought the first shot was a warning shot not to go ashore. After that, there were shots, gee whiz, all kinds of shots. And when they commenced, all ran to the other side and the boat began to tip. The passengers avoided capsizing the boat and turned around to flee back to Seattle. At least five IWW members on board were killed, along with two of the deputies. After the violence, the Shingle Workers Union called off their strike. 74 IWW members were arrested, but only one stood trial. None were convicted. Ernest Nordstrom followed up with, "I'm sure there is no excuse for this whatsoever. There need have been no bloodshed." For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, Colorado Democratic Governor Jared Polis in a little hot seat right now. And look, this could be a good thing. ProPublica has come out with a report that says that during the years 2013, 14, and 15, the tech entrepreneur and former congressman used every donation possible, every financial arrangement, everything he could possibly legally do to get out of paying taxes. Now, understand, in 2017, they said he was the third wealthiest guy in Congress with an estimated wealth of $306 million. But during that period from 10 to 18, he paid just 8.2%, even though his average yearly income was over $1.5 million. This is an opportunity to go, yeah, I did that. It was legal and it's wrong. We should be doing something better. Now, the average working person in this country, according to ProPublica, says that they pay about a 19% tax rate over on their income, which, you know, I got a problem with that. I'm here to share some thoughts on maybe how this works and where we need to be going forward. I've asked our good friend Morris Pearl to come talk with us. Morris is the chief cook and bottle washer, the chairman over at the Patriotic Millionaires. Morris, thanks for taking time for us.
Great to be in your show again, Rick.
So looking at Jared Polis's predicament here, I see an opportunity. I see a chance for him to go, yeah, this is what my financial people did. And it's wrong. It shouldn't be this way. There's a chance here to do something good.
Yeah, that's the whole point of that we've been trying to make all this time, is that rich people don't have to pay much taxes, because we have in this country an income tax system on taxable income. Now, if you make money from your salary and you get a paycheck with money deducted from that paycheck every single week, well, you know what your income is, you know what your taxes are, it's fairly clear. But for somebody like me, my income is from my stock portfolio. I can take tons of money out and spend it and live very well and not have any income, because I don't only have income if I sell something and then I look back and see that I paid less for that thing that I sold whenever I bought it years ago. I don't have to do that. I don't have any money deducted from anything. So I can decide for myself if I want to pay taxes or not. And my tax rate is less than the average 19%, I'll tell you that.
Yeah. Now, you're literally the guy who wrote the book on taxing the rich. In fact, that's the name of the book, Tax the Rich, How Lies, Loopholes, and Lobbyists Make the Rich Even Richer. And again, you come back to this lobbyist component, because, you know, right now they're voting on this Build Back Better plan, which I think a lot of this stuff we desperately need, and polls really well. And it's the lobbyists who seem to be the ones who are holding this up the best.
It seems that way. I remember once, I'm sitting in my apartment on Park Avenue. I remember once just over there, I was in a penthouse meeting with some, you know, cocktail party with a senator once. And he said, oh, it's a good thing I'm not a self-funder like this other guy is, because the only place like this where I meet regular people. I thought, you really think that people who paid $1,000 to talk to you for a few minutes over a glass of wine are regular people? But after a while, they tend to forget everybody else. Yeah, because those are the people they've spent all of their time with.
Yeah, and this is why I've said, you know, Democrats, when they go home, they should find a picket line. They should grab onto a worker and get a master's class on working class economics and find out what average everyday people are really going through and try and address some of those struggles. Because, look, you know, we've done very well for the wealthy. I mean, you know, we have a period right now where we've got 745 certified USDA certified billionaires who did really well during the pandemic. Some of that should filter down, because we were told trickle down was going to happen, hasn't, but some of it should.
And it's not like God's countenance shined upon these people and God said you should be rich. A bunch of them are rich because of things their grandparents or parents did, and they inherited money. A bunch of them are rich because of the pandemic.
Yeah.
Because, you know, companies like Amazon sold so much more stuff during the pandemic because we couldn't go shopping. So I think that we should be charging at least the same tax rates for rich people as we do for people who work for a living. It's just ridiculous that I have a lower tax rate than you do, Rick.
Yeah, and how we calculate different kinds of income. Income should be income. I mean, you know, the fact that you get a lower rate because you bought stock than someone who's driving a truck or swinging a hammer just seems inherently rigged from the beginning.
It's like the Congress people think, oh, we have a shortage of hedge fund managers, so we need to give them a special tax break. Maybe we have a shortage of emergency room nurses. They should get a special tax break. I think we have a shortage of truck drivers right now. Maybe they should get a special tax break. I have not seen any evidence of a shortage of hedge fund managers.
Yeah. No, in fact, you know, to your point, now that you mention it, because I am a truck driver, one of the things that the last tax code change did was take away all of the benefits a truck driver could have of their per diems and the costs of doing, you know, gloves and boots and the things that they need to do their job. They took all that away. So it was kind of a shot to them while still giving the wealthy their tax breaks.
That's part of the problem, is that not a lot of truck drivers show up at these $1,000 person fundraisers and schmooze with their senators and congresspeople. I don't know why not, but...
I got to tell you, I've met a lot of people in Congress. I know a lot of people in Congress. I'm not paying $1,000 to go sit down with them. I'm just not. It's not that important to me. But, you know, I do understand how the game is played. And I have friends who are in Congress, and one of them told me, look, no one's ever bought my vote. Morris, no one's ever bought my vote. But they did get my ear for 15 minutes, and that's what that $1,000 is about.
And after a few years, they spend so much time with these people, and they hear so much about, oh, the frustrations of rich people who have this investment income and they have to send in a check to the IRS every once in a while and get out their pen and an envelope and a stamp and mail it in. And, oh, it's so frustrating. And they hear that so long, after a few years, even the best of them tend to believe it.
So let me ask you this, because the story that we're told, Morris, is that if I give you all the money, because you're the smart guy in the room, you're the smartest guy in the room here. If I give you all the money, you're going to know what to do with it, and it's going to filter down, and it's going to be better for everyone. That's the story that we're told, that we have to give the best and the brightest to take care of the rest of us. Has that worked out?
It doesn't filter down. Money filters up. When all these people in New York are all paying their iPhone bills and buying stuff on iTunes and ordering stuff on Amazon that comes in cardboard boxes and has to be delivered, I get a little bit of money because all these companies I invest in make a little bit of money, whether it's Verizon or Apple or Amazon or any of these. And every time somebody spends money at one of these things, that makes people like me who invest in these companies a little bit richer. Money is filtering up, Rick, not down.
Right. And so what, you know, if you had the ability to set a tax system, you know, I advocate for returning to the good socialist president Dwight David Eisenhower's era, where we had a system where the bigger your shoulders, the more water you carried back to the cave kind of mentality. What is the right system? You know, I don't want to disinvest. I don't want to disincentivize people from investing, but it's not the end all, be all, do all that we need as a society, in my view. What is a better system, do you think?
Think of somebody like me for a minute. I have a bunch of money to invest. I've not worked since 2014, okay, in the early part of the years when I retired when I was 54. Now, I have a bunch of money, and I live off the investment returns on that money, and I spend some of it. Now, if the tax rate is 20%, I keep 80% and send 20% of the profits to the government. Of course, profits are ill-defined, but that's a different story. If the tax rate was 50%, I would keep half and send half. If the tax rate was 90%, I would keep 10% and send 90%. I would never just take all the money and stick it in a box under my bed. Then I'd get zero. And even keeping part of the money is better than zero.
Right.
So this whole disincentive thing, they're making up this idea that, oh, rich investors are going to go on strike. It's not like we're Teamsters. We're not going on strike. It doesn't work that way.
You're not taking your money and going overseas, because this is the other thing I hear. If we tax someone like you, Morris, you're just going to leave the country.
Even if I went overseas, I'd still have to pay the same taxes. We tax American citizens on their income, whether they're here or not. And no, I'm not going to give up my American citizenship. And even if I did, there'd be a huge tax on that too. We charge people for giving up their citizenship. So no, that's a complete crock.
It's a farce.
I'm not sending my money overseas. I'm not going overseas.
But ultimately, you know, we're in this position where, you know, you look at this Build Back Better plan, which, you know, polls really well. It's paid for by raising reasonable amount of taxes on people making over $400,000. I don't think this is too onerous in a moment of need in this country, especially given the fact that we are the wealthiest country in the history of civilization at probably its wealthiest moment. This doesn't seem too much.
It's not. And I want to keep our country wealthy. And like I said, with money trickling up, I want to keep a lot. I want to live in a country with lots of people who pay those bills every month so that money does continue to trickle up to the investors and business people. I don't want to live in a country with a few rich people and lots of poor people. They tried that in South Africa when I was a teenager. It did not end well for the rich people, Rick.
No. Eventually the pitchforks come out and we know that, but we still have people who are hell-bent on, we've got to cater to the wealthy. And I look at this, you know, one of the changes during the last tax code change during the former guy's administration was to increase taxes on, or to cap taxes on state and local tax bases, the SALT tax, if you will. There are people who are hell-bent on returning to, you know, removing that cap. What's the right answer here? Is there an answer here? Because ultimately, you know, I don't want to be paying for people who are living in gigantic mansions, but I also don't want working class people to get tied up in this as well. Is there a way forward on doing something on the SALT?
Well, there's a couple of proposals have come up. One was from Senator Sanders of Vermont and Senator Menendez of New Jersey. They had a compromise of only lifting the SALT deduction cap for people that earn less than $400,000 a year. I'd be fine with that. And there's another proposal on the House side of just raising the cap to, I think, $70,000 or $80,000 from $10,000. Now, that wouldn't make too much of a difference if you're a multi-billionaire, whether it's $10,000 or $70,000. But $70,000 would cover all of your middle-class people who have big property tax bills. So I think either one of those is good. I'd prefer the one with simply says they'll reduce the, they'll get rid of the cap for people that earn less than $400,000 a year would be my
choice. Yeah, I mean, we can see, this is the thing that gets me. We can do smart things. It doesn't have to be all or nothing. There are no zero-sum games, in my view. We can do some of this stuff. But here's the problem. Yeah. We've got to do something. And I look at what happened on Tuesday, and I want to get your assessment of the results of Tuesday, especially in Virginia and New Jersey. I think it's a testament of not getting things done and being able to go to voters and going, look, this is the bacon we're bringing home. This is how we're making lives better.
Well, I think you're right. I think the Congress people know that too. I happened to be at a retreat with 17 U.S. senators on the Democratic side just last weekend at a resort. And to a man or a woman, they said, we have to deliver. We have to pass these bills. We have to have something to deliver to the American people when we go campaigning, you know, in 2022. And they all know that, and they have to. I mean, they have to pass some laws to provide these things like child care, like education to the American people. And they know that.
So in looking at what happened on Tuesday, I know there are a lot of people saying the sky's falling. You know, Democrats are in big trouble. I'm not as concerned right now as I will be in a couple of months, especially if nothing gets done on the infrastructure side. How concerned are you about 2022?
I mean, I can't even think a whole year ahead. I'm concerned about what's going to happen, you know, in the next week about passing these bills. You know, election day 2022, that's outside of my planning horizon, to tell you the truth. But I agree with you that I hope the Democrats deliver something.
Yeah, so I understand they're voting as we speak. Any hope that things get done here?
Hope, yeah, sure. I mean, as I've been saying, I'll believe it when I see the president's signature.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They've been telling me it's right around the corner since, I think, August.
And this is the thing that's been getting me. I'm going to go, you know, this should have been done over the summer so that it actually got into place and starts filtering down and starts making people's lives better. Because ultimately, Morris, you know, it's my view that the way things are framed are way off. We're framing things as progressive as moderate or right or left, where the reality is it's up down. It's sadly, it's the class war kind of things. It's, you know, the very wealthy doing very well and everybody else still struggling.
And unfortunately, there are a few people on the Democratic side and everyone on the Republican side who don't want to tax the rich, who don't want to do these things. It's essentially, you know, you're talking about taxing more on rich people and giving more benefits to people that work for a living. And there are some people who are more greedy and they don't like that.
Yeah, you know? But you know, my view on it is: look, there's a difference between being rich and, oh my God, you have more than you're going to spend in multiple generations. The massive accumulation of wealth in this country is kind of dangerous, at a dangerous level at this point. I love people who are doing really well. I think it's important that we have that. But when you're talking about, you know, Jeff Bezos, you're talking about, you know, Elon Musk kind of territory up there where you're talking multiple generations down the road couldn't waste the kind of money that they've got. That's a problem, I think.
Well, I mean, I don't mind. I mean, I don't think it's a problem with a small number of ultra rich people. You know, we've had people like the Rockefellers and the Morgans and, you know, Carnegie and Mellon, and we've had very rich people in this country before. That's not the problem. The problem is what I don't want is millions and millions of people who can't get by and are going to give up and are going to get addicted to opioids and are going to just stop cooperating and say, oh, I'd rather vote for revolution. You know, send in some billionaire with orange hair who'll tear the whole country apart and maybe I'll be better off. And that's what I'm afraid of.
Or walking,
I'm not worried about Jeff Bezos.
Or walking through Dealey Plaza with a Trump JFK Jr. flag. And there being no mental health money in this Build Back Better plan.
Yeah. I mean, we need to realize we're all in this together. I mean, maybe not every last person. Maybe there are a few billionaires rich enough to make their money by extracting minerals from the earth, and they don't really care about anyone else. But for the most part, most investors, most business people, most people on Main Street and Wall Street, they need the whole country to succeed. Yep. They need everybody or almost everybody be doing okay in order for investments and businesses to survive. We are in this together, and we have to understand that.
That is the message. The book, Tax the Rich, How Lies, Loopholes, and Lobbyists Make the Rich Even Richer, co-authored by Morris Pearl. You can get that at patrioticmillionaires.org. Make sure you check out their work. Morris, it's always great talking with you, always fun. I appreciate you taking time for us.
Thank you. Great.
Good stuff. Morris Pearl, again, the head chief cook and bottle washer there at Patriotic Millionaires. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1855. That was the day that Eugene V. Debs was born in Terre Haute, Indiana. Debs was forced to leave school when he was just 14 years old. He worked as a railroad fireman. In 1875, Debs founded the Brotherhood of Locomotive Firemen. Early on, Debs was a Democrat. In 1884, he was elected to the Indiana State Assembly. However, Debs soon moved further left politically. He decided that union brotherhoods were ineffective because they divided workers who worked at different jobs in the same industry. He decided to organize a new kind of railroad workers' union. In 1893, he became the president of the American Railway Union. This industrial union rose to national prominence due to its support of the Pullman workers' strike. Debs was jailed twice during the Pullman strike for defying a federal injunction ordering striking workers to return to work and for contempt of court. Debs spent 6 months in jail. While in prison, he read about socialism, and in 1900 and 1904, Debs was the Socialist Party's presidential nominee. Debs was also a founding member of the International Workers of the World, or Wobblies. States. When the United States entered World War I, Debs was an outspoken opponent of the war. He said, "They're continually talking about your patriotic duty. Their patriotic duty never takes them to the firing line or chucks them into the trenches." Debs was sent to a federal penitentiary for opposing the war. While in jail in 1920, he again ran for president and received nearly 1 million votes from behind bars. Debs was pardoned and released in 1921. After his second time in jail, his health took a turn for the worst. He returned to Terre Haute, where he died in 1926. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.